Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric.
And I'm Michelle. Today, Blair Horner of NYPIRG discusses the campaign finance proposals made by the New York State Public Finance Commission.
Then we hear Alexis Goldsmith's interview with Dr. Moise San Louis as they discuss the political unrest in Haiti.
And later on, Dr. Borton and WOOC Spirit, Megan Marone, discuss grief in the age of the climate crisis and reckoning with sorrow in a wasteful and stressful civilizational paradigm.
After that, we'll have a live interview on hacktivism in the Arts Department School of Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences at RPI.
Finally, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry interviews Herb Hennings, president of the Troy Area Labor Council, about their participation in the Victorian Stroll event.
Let's jump into some headlines. A water main break on Campbell Avenue in Troy has resulted in a boil water advisory for affected residents. You can contact the Troy Department of Public Utilities by calling 518-237-0611 to see if your home is part of that zone.
An Albany judge has dismissed a lawsuit that challenged the constitutionality of New York's controversial new school vaccination requirements after more than 50 families filed a lawsuit in July. The court ruled that it was clear that the law was motivated by public health concerns, not attacks on religion.
As the Trump administration implements more stringent mandates to obtain food stamps, New York plans to scrap fingerprinting requirements for all public assistance applicants. It had previously scrapped it for food stamps, and now the Trump administration's new work requirements for SNAP applicants will require able-bodied adults without children to work at least 20 hours a week. The change could affect over 100,000 people in New York. Democrats unveiled on Tuesday two articles of impeachment, accusing President Donald Trump of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The Judiciary Committee is slated to vote on the articles later this week, setting up a full House vote later next week. Democrats said Trump put his personal political interests over U.S. national security by pressuring Ukraine to investigate his political rivals. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA 106.9 FM Albany, and now WCAA 107.3 FM Albany.
To learn more about the program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Up next, Blair Horner of NYPIRG discusses the campaign finance proposals made by the New York State Public Finance Commission with Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We talk with Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, New York Public Interest Research Group. WOC has covered quite a few stories about problems with the Public Finance Commission and its proposals related to third parties. We wanted to talk to Blair about how the Public Finance Commission actually did in terms of trying to rein in the impact of large donors and special interest money in their proposals. So, Blair, what's your evaluation on the finance proposals by the Public Finance Commission?
Well, if the criteria you use is do they rein in big money, then the commission failed. They don't rein in big money in any meaningful way. They lower campaign contribution limits from ridiculously sky high to just sky high. They left the huge donations you can make to party committees, they left them intact. And so a Republican political committee can raise $117,000 campaign contributions and transfer it to the candidate of their choice, just like they can under the current system. And so effectively, if you know what you're doing, $100,000 campaign contribution is perfectly legal under New York law. So if the standard is big money, then they failed. If the standard is that they create a system of public financing that could help grassroots candidates raise money to run for office, then, you know, it's not as clear what happened. They created a system of public financing, so that exists. They didn't follow the New York City model, which sort of flabbergasted from my perspective because it's in New York State. It follows state law. There's a 30-year track record. You would think you would just follow best practice and build out from there. They didn't. They dreamt up something completely new. Not necessarily a bad idea, but it's untested. And so how that works is unclear. But there will be a system of public financing that may be able to help grassroots candidates to mount a challenge or for incumbents to not have to rely on big money as much in order to run for office.
One of the complaints by some of the more insurgent-type organizations is that the actual number of qualifying contributions is really beyond the means of most insurgent candidates. Unless you're really sort of an establishment candidate with some type of major funding stream behind you, it's not clear really how many sort of maverick independent candidates are going to be able to actually meet the thresholds required. Do you have any assessment on that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair critique of it. You're going to have to demonstrate that you can get a reasonably large number of small donations, but you can get a reasonable, you can do it. The way that they set up the public financing system is that any donation up to $50 will be matched 12 to 1 with public resources. And then as it goes up, it's 9 to 1 for the next $100, and then 8 to 1 for the next $100, up to a maximum of $250 donations. Large donations, it's not like they get – there will be no public financing for the first 250 of the $3,000 donation you might give to somebody running for the assembly. So it really has to be small donors, and they have to be in district. You can't get – small donations from outside of the district. So those are going to be steep hills to climb. And then you're right, there will also be you have to have a certain minimum number, you have to raise a certain minimum amount depending on what office you're running for. Nevertheless, it is a system. And right now, if you're a challenger, you got nothing unless you have friends that are wealthy or you are working with powerful interest groups. It's very hard to raise money against an incumbent. And now you'll have a chance to do it. So that's the best I can come up with as to what they did. Most of what the commission did, they did in secret. They did as if they were sort of just following the tune of their appointing authorities. They weren't acting independently.
Their appointing authorities being the party leadership or the legislative and the governor?
That's right. The governor and the legislative leaders picked the members of the commission. And some of the more embarrassing parts of the meetings where they're all looking at their phones, seemingly waiting for the text message about what they're supposed to be doing, because within minutes they would often change their votes. Magically, as if so. It was a terrible process. It was really awful. In some ways, worse than just having the legislature do it, because there were no committee meetings. There was no real meaningful debate, it was controlled by the Democrats. As you mentioned earlier, what they seemed to be focused on was crushing minor parties more than anything else.
Now, I understand the public campaign finance proposals itself are not going into effect for maybe 3 years. Sort of two-part question. One, how does this compare to what other states have done on public campaign finance? And then second, will the government, good government groups, attempt amendments during the upcoming legislative session?
Well, the first question is the only thing that I've seen that's actually in place that looks sort of like what they came up with is Montgomery County in Maryland has a sliding scale in-district match system. They've used it, as I recall, for one election cycle in 2018. They had a relatively small number of candidates, I think seven, that actually participated in the program. So it's not a real in-depth track record, but there is stuff that's out there that's similar.
Well, perhaps a more focused question would be, how do the systems that use public campaign finance compare to the limits they put on the size of individual donations compared to New York?
Well, again, the New York thing is different because you have this sliding scale. There really is a powerful incentive to get, $20 donations because they get matched 12 to 1. And so there's not that many systems that have that kind of extremely high match. Now, you have to get them from inside the district. And so it may be relatively easy to do that in more affluent suburban areas of the state. It may be much harder to do it in poor rural areas or poor urban areas to sort of get enough people that want to pony up you know, $20, which they may be just scratching to make it along. So it's a different system. It's an untested system. Why they chose to do that, only they can answer, instead of just following what New York City does and then sort of tweaking it from there. So we'll see. Now, in terms of amendments, yes, we are pushing, we'll be pushing for the, during the upcoming session, we are pushing now. The statute says that the legislature and the governor have until December 22nd to make any kind of changes, or this proposal that came forth from the commission goes into effect. That means that unless they think the system that they came up with is perfect, they should act, and they should act before this goes into effect. Otherwise, they're behaving irresponsibly. They have a require. They wrote it, and nobody dreamt this up. This is their idea. They said, we're going to have this thing go into effect by this commission by December 1st. We're going to take until December 22nd to fix it if we think anything needs to be fixed. Unless they think it's perfect, and I haven't heard any of them say that, unless they think it's perfect, they have responsibility between now and the holidays to fix it. And that's what we're pushing right now.
While certainly a number of individual legislators have voiced complaints and concerns and need to come back to Albany, that does not seem to be what the legislative leaders and the governor are saying at this point.
Yeah. I mean, they seem to have achieved whatever it was that they wanted to achieve. They stick it to the minor parties. They don't meaningfully change the system of private donations to the system. And they came up with a public financing system, which is going to be challenging, let's be honest, for anyone for any grassroots candidate, insurgent candidate, to meet the various standards. We've seen this before. They came up with a public financing system for comptroller about 5 years ago. The incumbent didn't opt in, and the challenger couldn't meet the onerous standards.
And the challenger being the Republican.
And the challenger being the Republican. And then, by the way, just to oversee the whole thing, the system is going to be administered by the New York State Board of Elections, who, let's be charitable, have mixed reviews when it comes to dealing with campaign finances. They tweak it a little bit, but fundamentally the board is still going to run it. And that means that the two major parties can collude against minor parties in those circumstances as well.
If people want to find out more about what's going on with the Public Finance Commission, is there a good place for them to look for information?
Well, if they want the basic stuff, there is if you Google, you know, New York State Commission on Public Finance, they have their own website. It's pretty barren, but at least you could see their report. We're part of a coalition called Fair Elections in New York. You could Google that, and there's information on that site. We've put out a reasonably detailed memorandum to both houses of the legislature, all members, urging action, and it's similar to some of the things that we have posted on our website as well, NYPIRG.org.
And that's been Blair Horner, Executive Director of NYPIRG, and this is Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Blair Horner of NYPIRG discussing campaign finance proposals made by the New York State Public Finance Commission with Hudson Mohawk correspondent Mark Dunley.
Haitian scholar Dr. Moïse Saint-Louis is a political scholar with a Ph.D. in comparative politics and international relations. He joins Hudson Mohawk correspondent Alexis Goldsmith to discuss the violent unrest happening in Haiti.
Haiti has been the country where U.S. regime change operations like the current one in Bolivia have conducted laboratory experiments going back decades. The most recent was the coup that overthrew the democratically elected President Aristide. Welcome, Moïse. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you please describe the current situation in Haiti?
Well, what is happening in Haiti is reflective of the Haitian people's determination to have a state and a government that responds to their needs and to remove the external influence and to hold their government accountable and compel the government in place to answer and meet their needs. Part of that challenge, as you keenly pointed out, is that the Haitian people have found that their hope for a democratic system that responds to their needs have been usurped and corrupted. And so they have taken to the street to demand a democracy that is not elite-led, that is not interest, external interest and elite interest dependent, but one that accounts for their needs and account for their future and their children's future.
Now, what is the U.S. interest in Haiti, and why was the government corrupted? How did this even happen?
Well, you know, one of the ways to understand U.S. policy in the Caribbean and Latin America is a policy based on economic interest and political interest. And so left-leaning government that are popularly supported tends to create policies that use their resources to benefit the population. So what that often means is that those resources that are already captured by Western corporations and by the small elite cliques and cosmopolitan elites are in contention when you have government that are responsive to the needs of their population. And so as a consequence, U.S. political and economic interests, which is a corporate interest, have tried to undermine or overthrow those governments who are more responsive to their population. And so what we see happening throughout Latin America and what we see that Venezuela is under the gun is no different than what we're seeing in Haiti. The difference is, the Haitian population, because of their history, have always found it necessary to put their foot forward and to put their foot on the ground to try to shift the paradigm and reassert control over their state.
So just for clarification, it sounds like what you're saying is that the corruption in the Haitian government goes back to corruption in the U.S. government and the U.S. government trying to throw its weight into international affairs. Is that an accurate interpretation?
Well, more so than throwing its weight, the U.S. government has forcefully implemented and imposed its will and its rule on governments in Haiti, and in fact has overthrown legitimately democratic elected government to impose government that is not widely supported by the population. So I'll give you an example. So the Haitian people really believe in a democracy that's responsive to their needs, right? And so in the first election in 1987, Haitians elected their government by participated in the democratic system by 60%. 90% of the population participated, 60% voted for their democratically elected government and supported the government. That government was overthrown by the CIA and the national elites because it was responding to the population's need. The population compelled a return of the government. And in the second round, they supported that government by 90% of their votes. And that government was again overthrown by France and the United States and the local elites because that government was responsive to the needs of this population. And so as a consequence, what the average Haitians have realized is that the democracy they seek is not the democracy that is wanted. And so they have refused to participate in elections. So that you've seen a decline in electoral participation from 90% to 17.3%.
So as Haitians are trying to assert their sovereignty, there's reports of violence coming out against Haitian journalists, demonstrators, bystanders being shot, beaten and arrested during this more than year-long on-again, off-again protests. What is the state of the violence right now, and is there any chance to restore democracy?
Well, I think the future will tell what is part of the Haitian genius is that once the population, it's a population that fought for its independence, who has a history of resistance. And so the reality is once the population is on the ground, it's hard to put the genie back in its box. And so the population will exert more and more pressure regardless of the violence. That is the way in which the population has always interacted. So there's considerable violence. I mean, the reality is you see that even in the United States. As inequality goes up, the militarized state is consolidated. And there's greater police actions, more a militarized police that uses extreme force and that, right? And so that's no different. And that model is the kind of resources the U.S. shared with the countries it seeks to impose its wills on to facilitate their ability to maintain control over the population. And so what you see as the population begins to exercise control and demands for more rights and a state that is responsive to their needs, you see that the police force comes out with greater violence, more weapons, and quite a number of rubber bullets and other ways to really compel the population and back into its home. But I think knowing the history of the Haitian people, that is likely to happen without some outcome that answers to their needs.
How has the Haitian culture been affected by this unrest? How has the Haitian culture been affected by the
Haitian
unrest?
Culture?
Mm-hmm.
I think Haitian culture is not impacted per se, but Haitians prize education, right? Haitians value education and the ability of their kids to go to school and so on. And so part of what is happening, it really closes down the schools so that schools are not functioning in the way in which they function normally. And that creates quite a level of tension within the Haitian populace, that they want to be able to send their kids to school, but the way in which the government is being controlled and the way in which the government is functioning does not really meet their needs. They see that they are being marginalized, meaning the ability to have resources to send their kids to school is becoming more and more limited. And the government is not responding to their needs, and their protest is increasing violence so that they won't send their kids to school for fear of violence. And so it creates an untenable situation, not impacting the culture, but impacting the way in which Haitians value education and their conflict with having their kids attend schools.
So it sounds like the youth have been especially affected by this.
That's correct. Based in both in their ability to go to school and also both in their trajectory, in their ability to be successful after school based on what is happening in the government.
So is there anything that U.S. citizens can do for Haiti? And should the U.S. take a warning from this?
Well, I think two things, right? I always say in engaging with my fellow Americans, that one of the things that they have to think about, the type of government you have here is the type of is the kind of influence that happens in other countries. That if you're able to shape a more accountable government in the United States, then that might impact the type of influence they have on other countries and the kind of policies they have in other countries. And I think in many ways, Americans are in a particular position. Are being asked some fundamental questions about whether in fact they value democracy, whether they want to be manipulated in fear. Because often, what is clear is the model the Americans have used to manipulate other countries, the model that is being used to manipulate the American people. So in many ways, there is a call to conscience for the American people to reassert their own control over their own government. And I think that has that will have repercussion for the kind of influence and impact the American government has on other nations. So I really think the outcome of what is happening right now in Congress with the impeachment, the outcome in the upcoming election may really have a greater impact on the role America is currently playing in the rest of the world.
That was Dr. Moise Saint-Louis discussing violent unrest happening in Haiti with WOOC correspondent Alexis Goldsmith.
For those just tuning in, I'm Eric.
And I'm Michelle. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA 107.3 FM Albany.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Up next, Dr. David Borton is back with Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. In this episode, Dr. Borton and WOOC Megan Marone discuss grief in the age of the climate crisis and reckoning with sorrow in a wasteful and stressful civilizational paradigm.
Hey, Dr. Borton.
Megan, always good to see you.
Great to see you. We're having a huge storm. And, you know, I have to admit, moment of honesty time, I've been pretty caught up these days in the latest of the climate news and accepting grief over the life that we've already lost, but also getting frustrated about what to do in the face of extreme climate news, like the newest UN report just came out. We talked before about the 11,000 scientists who, you know, signed the letter about how extreme the climate emergency is. But, you know, the UN report just coming out saying that we are moving closer and closer to these tipping points, and then other sources saying, you know, scientists in Exeter saying that we are at these tipping points. There are 11 different things that they're looking at. The melting of Antarctica, the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, all of these different points of reference on the planet in which things are becoming, they're unraveling from what they're used to seeing in terms of patterns that you could rely on. So I just wanted to get your input on that, because also I feel like some of our listeners can relate to this. It can feel lonely. You're taking in this extreme information and then you really need a community to process it.
And right now we are experiencing a snowstorm and it's rather cold out and lots of snow. What's happening is that there's more and more heat coming in at the equator, and the Earth is trying to keep an energy balance, meaning keep the same amount of energy. And the way it does that is it radiates heat back into space. And the best place for heat to radiate back into space is from the poles, the North Pole and the South Pole. Now, in order for heat to get there, you have to move the heat from the equatorial zones up toward the north. And if you're moving air up there, that's going to displace some cold air from there, and it's going to have to come south. And it's that mixing, that's weather and climate, that is trying to keep some equilibrium on our only little small blue planet.
What is your emotional reaction to this news? As someone who has been working in solar since 1974, so your life has always been geared towards this truth of how... Well, I would say it's a truth about our economy. It's a truth about our energy use and about how we live our lives. So what is your, given that your life has been about this, what is your emotional reaction to this news?
Well, there's a lot of, I'll call it sorrow. I'm sorry that I couldn't in my lifetime affect more people. But this is such a difficult long-term thing, and it's abstract. And abstract thinking can be difficult for a mammal that has survived through evolution by responding to short-term things. This is not a short-term thing. This is a long-term thing, changing the whole climate on the Earth.
You know, if you take a philosophy 101 class, you learn about ethics. You know, you might read something like, you know, Aristotelian ethics, or read Spinoza and think about, like you were talking about, abstraction, think about behavior and ideas of morality and right and wrong and abstraction about why certain, you know, humans do certain destructive things or certain good things. So it feels like in that basic philosophy realm, you learn that if you come to know something, you should act on it. But we live in highly complex systems. And so the frustration that I have and that many of my friends have is that the systems bifurcate us from the natural world. And then it becomes hard to just look at that information and directly act. Now, I know many people that are acting in really creative ways to mediate that situation. But we also live in a post-colonial context in which our air, water, food has been taken as a resource, you know, and then sold back to us. So in some ways, the news also highlights the trickiness of our systems. Would you agree?
Oh, yes. And let me give you an example, and that is that George Bush, who is not necessarily the most climate-friendly person, thought that there should be some mechanism to balance the playing field between gasoline cars and electric vehicles. And so he had, I believe it was the OMB that did an analysis of what it would take to balance this subsidy for gasoline cars with a subsidy for electric vehicles. And you know how big that subsidy is?
How much?
$7,500. Where did that number come from? And that number is looking at the U.S. subsidy for gasoline, which, depending on how you count, is between $5 and $15 per gallon. And if you extend that over some life of a vehicle and you discount that to present-day value, the people who did this calculation, came up with the number $7,500. So that's how much gasoline cars are being subsidized just to make an even playing field. And electric vehicles got that just to try to make it even. So it is very complex. It's abstract. We're talking here tax policy and politics. And so those are very difficult things. Science is pretty easy and straightforward. The scientists would say, okay, look, stop that subsidy today. Okay? Politicians don't think that way. So it's very difficult, as you said. It's a very difficult problem.
Over the holidays, my brother and I were talking about the complexity of how, you know, very wealthy countries, you know, countries that also we get the perception of as doing the right thing, like Sweden has many policies about recycling. And yet for the G20 countries, there are the huge fossil fuel subsidies. You know, you're just living with those contradictions, which can be really frustrating. And also the UN report said that in terms of the countries that are causing this pollution, it's all of the G20 countries.
Oh, yes. The history of what we call economic progress has been to devastate the natural resources of this planet. It's just incredible how much we use, and we think that use is good, and we think our life is better for all of this stuff that we have. Our houses are full of stuff, and the advertising wants us to buy more stuff, and all of this stuff is somehow or other degrading the environment of the whole planet.
So what would you say, as someone who's worked in solar energy for, you know, a great deal of your adult life, what would you say to your average human who is reading this news and feeling quite overwhelmed?
Well, get ready for change. Some of the change you can do yourself, and that will be hopefully very easy. Some of the change you can ask your politicians for, and that is probably quite difficult. Some of the change is probably in between, and that is things like looking at who you buy stuff from and how much stuff you buy. Those are choices that you make all the time, and if you start making those choices in a knowledgeable way about the environment, then you can start changing the economics of the whole problem.
I really like the idea of also changing forms of activism, moving activism from always being about one type of thing, whether that's nonviolent direct action protest or direct, you know, legislative appeal and going down the road of appealing to the policymakers, and starting to look at the world and say that activism can be any act of compassion with other humans on the earth right now, that is what is needed. You know, sometimes just listening is needed. Sometimes, you know, certain skills, if you know how to put up solar panels, you know, something, when the crisis is at this level, you could look at everybody and try to just say, look it, we're all in this together, almost like a call, like a hospice call. It's interesting, in those moments of hospice care, people get a sense of how valuable and precious life is and how little time we have. I keep thinking about that in the context of the climate emergency, that there's kind of this spiritual call to shape up and not act like time is infinite, and that this wasteful, stressful existence is all that we have, that we could be acting more compassionately.
Well, yes, and by talking about it on the radio, some people are going to understand what we're talking about, and they're going to think about it. And by thinking about it, they're going to change things in their lives. And that change, that education, is very important. So thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Dr. Borton.
It's always a pleasure, Megan.
We just heard Dr. Borton, WOOC correspondent Megan Moran, discuss grief in the age of the climate crisis and reckoning with sorrow in a wasteful and stressful civilization paradigm.
Up next, we'll be doing a live interview with Dan Pfeiffer and Emma Goldman on hacktivism in the Arts Department, School of Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences at RPI. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's great to be here.
So we're just super interested in this very concept. And one question we had for you, we were talking a little bit about the show. Why is it exactly that hacktivism falls under the Arts Department at RPI?
Well, on a like base level, the professor who is intended to teach the course teaches in the Arts Department, so like very physically, like it is in the Arts Department because of the way that the professor teaches it. In working with Dan to teach this class, I think that my emphasis was hopefully to be placed on the sort of arts aspect of it and creating a collaborative environment where things are created and like basically like kind of hacking the environment in more than just computer science-y kind of terms.
Yeah, I come from a tech background, so I'm probably taking I've taught it for the first time this semester with Emma. This is definitely like a more technological iteration of it, but we definitely take an expansive view of what hacktivism is. A lot of people might imagine, you know, someone with a balaclava on, you know, typing on their laptop in a darkened room, doing like terrible things. That's an aspect of hacktivism, and we did do some readings around that. But there's another meaning of hacktivism too, which is from like the early computing era, where people were just hacking computers out of joy in order to fulfill some vision of what computing could be. And we took that even further and thought like, well, hacktivism can include other things like grafting branches, fruit, you know, bearing branches onto street trees in order to like literally hack, you know, that capacity onto them.
Yeah.
And a range of other things. But yeah, it's a very expansive definition.
That is really interesting. And so I guess that's another thing, is that like you were saying, people imagine is the person like hiding in the dark, and there's like this sort of illegal connotation with hacking anything. But you're saying that that's not really what you're going for with this class?
I think there are aspects of it where we emphasize the pushing of boundaries, but it's not inherently, I think, illegal or like meant to be outside of the sphere. I think it is meant to be really, I don't know what the word for it is, when you go against the grain of something.
Adversarial, maybe?
Yeah, adversarial. Yeah. It's not meant to be sort of inherently making of conflict, but it is, I think, meant to point out what's wrong with certain situations and how can we make those situations better by making them more accessible or educating around them or just,
And I would say, I should say up front that the syllabus did say explicitly, like, we're interested in legal forms of hacking.
Yes.
And I wanted to make sure this was in writing for my own sake.
Right.
But also, I think it was important for the class to think about how the law influences our behavior and whether unjust laws should be upheld. And I made a point to make the students understand that I care more about the ethics of their actions than the strict legality of things. Given that, I mean, for one thing, I'm not a lawyer, and what's legal or not changes over time and in different contexts, and the law is upheld inconsistently. There's a lot to, like, whether or not something's legal. It's not so straightforward.
So there's a big ethical component then to this class.
Definitely, but also power. I think a lot of times we talk about ethics when we're unwilling to talk about power. And I think hacktivism is a form of overcoming not having power and using your skills to do something surprising or...
Yeah. Giving power to people who wouldn't otherwise have it, I think. One of the organizations we talked about was the CURB. I forget what that stands for, but it's basically making food accessible. And I think one of the best discussions we had in this class was after the grafting discussion, talking about like grafting fruit branches onto non-fruit bearing trees, and the difference that has in a practical versus sort of aesthetic effect on a community, as opposed to inciting community gardens and the ways that that can change an environment and how that works. And so having more accessible things that people can actively do versus things that are making a statement so that people are more aware of what's going on.
So if you were not in the class and you wanted to get involved, you know, you're talking about, you know, grassroots activism. How does that work with this class?
Well, I mean, it's hard. I think it's a skill that I hope my students will continue to develop beyond the class. We definitely did some projects that were intended to reach into the RPI community and outside of campus as well. But that's a challenge. If I was going to teach it a second time, I would probably get to the organizing parts earlier. I think maybe we waited too long.
Yeah, I think that having organizing earlier, but in people who haven't taken the class, I think that the biggest thing is just like educating yourself as best as you can about what's going on in your environment and looking at the things that you don't necessarily agree with or the things that you would like to change and seeing then further what you can do to change it. I think that everyone should have an opportunity to take a class like this, but there are so many resources at like public libraries and online and just in books, you know, just using these things to understand the situation and ways that you can change. And also looking at the ways that other people have fought for similar issues. So like the person who runs this class is one of the Yes Men from the Yes Men. And I think that he really, like he uses his work as examples as well as other people's. So being able to look at examples and state that yourself, I think, is a really powerful thing.
Was there anything interesting that you learned from the students in this class?
I mean, every day. Yeah, I mean, I'm new to teaching at RPI, so a lot of what was fun about it for me was just hearing about what it's like to be a student at RPI and coming to understand more of the nuance of the student experience there.
Do you have any guests who come in and lecture in the class?
We had a lot of guests, yeah.
Yeah, more guests than this class has ever had. One every week, almost, pretty much.
Yeah, I think this might be the first week when we didn't have a guest.
It's me.
Yeah.
It's me today.
Or am I the guest?
Yeah.
One of those.
Oh, both. It's fine.
So who have you had?
Oh, man, I should have a list handy.
Whoever you can...
We had Ellie come in and
Ellie
do
was
it.
A guest.
We had Darius, whose last name...
Kazemi.
Yeah, Kazemi.
What are they involved in? Yeah. Tell us about what they came to speak about.
So Darius, I know him from giving talks at conferences, and he's always one of my favorite people to give a talk. He has this thing where he makes a tiny side project and launches it out into the world. And he'll do it in like one evening, but he'll do it every day for like a long span of time. So he does hundreds of projects. And a lot of them are really good. I mean, some of them are like, you know, well, that was interesting. But and then some of them are like, wow, I wish that I had thought of that. And having him, he was a video guest. Some guests came in person and some guests beamed in using video chat. Hearing him talk about his process and just learning more about what kinds of things he works on. He's based in Portland, Oregon, and you know, he's a computer programmer, but he works with various, you know, social activist groups. And I basically brought all the people who I wanted to like have a chat with, and you know, just emailed them all, and a lot of them said yes.
Was there anyone who is really outside, or what would you say is the most outside the realm of what we traditionally think of like hacktivism to be? What is like one example you'd want to put out there? I know we did like grafting different fruit-bearing trees together. It seems like this is more about upsetting existing systems and taking control over them for people who otherwise don't have. Is that like a good broad definition, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think that... honestly, Igor is one of the best representations of hacktivism that we have. Igor Vamos, who was the professor initially, and he's not around right now. I don't really know where he is, probably in another country wandering, etc. But he just does such fantastic work and such like active work that seeing the ways that people can do things and make a difference just by kind of making a statement or like being funny a little bit is really, I think, empowering, because everyone can do that.
Is there a way that someone can become involved with a hacktivist movement? We're about to run out of time, but what can the audience, those listening at home who think, yes, this like is something that really interests me, what can they do?
I mean, I think it just takes feeling really strongly about something in the world and then feeling like you actually have a capacity to do something about it. And once you have those two things, it's kind of hard not to start actually following through on it. I mean, you have to like do the work, of course, but I might name a couple groups before we wrap up. Extinction Rebellion came up a lot. We looked a lot
friends
about
of the show.
Yeah, Friends of the Show. And Nobody Leaves Mid-Hudson also came up in a past session. But yeah, I mean, I think there's so many places for people to get involved here. I mean, I brought my students here for a reason.
We're going to have to wrap up. Thank you very much. And that was Dan Pfeiffer and Emma Goldman speaking on hacktivism at RPI.
And now WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Troy 37th Annual Victorian Stroll on Sunday, December 8th at the Troy Atrium. And this is part one of his segment with interviewing Herb Hennings.
This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk magazine, and I'm here today in the streets of Troy at the Troy Victoria Scroll. At a table inside the Troy Atrium that's sponsored by the Troy Area Labor Council, and they're here tabling today at the Troy Victoria Scroll. And I have as my guest the president of the Troy Area Labor Council, Herb Hemingway. And how you doing, Herb?
Okay, we are doing very well. We've met a lot of people, and we're talking up labor and unions and giving out information on unions and what unions do to the people who come into the Victorian Stroll here at the atrium.
So, Herb. So this is the Troy Area Labor Council. Like maybe some people don't know, you know, much about the Troy Area Labor Council. So tell us something about the Troy Area Labor Council. You know, what it is, what you do, and who do you represent?
The Troy Area Labor Council is the voice of labor in Rensselaer County. We represent 10,000 working men and their women and their families all through Rensselaer County and Troy and the city of Rensselaer and the towns throughout Rensselaer County. And what we do is we have delegates from the various unions, and we are we speak for labor in Rensselaer County, and we do the work of the AFL-CIO and the Area Labor Federation in this county, and politics, community activities.
How long has the Labor Council been around?
The Labor Council has been around for about 100 years or so. And originally, there was a labor temple in Troy, which doesn't exist anymore. And now we meet in the same building as City Hall.
So the Labor Council was around during the Victoria era, huh?
Certainly. It was around just after the Civil War. It was around for the early unions in Troy, for the shirt waist trade and all that in Troy.
Now, it's a very cold day today, you know, and I woke up, it was about 19 degrees. Now, you have a table here. Now, what do you hope to do by having a president today here at the Victoria School?
We hope to tell people and to give people information about what working people do and how we organize and what we have to do in order to make this country better and to fight against the forces that would divide us.
Now, Herb, I see you have people passing out bags around. Tell me, what's in the bag that you're passing out that says CSCA?
In the bag is a coloring book from CSCA. It teaches children about labor unions and working people and what we do. And also crayons so that they can color in the coloring book, and pencils and crayons, and there's a brochure about Occupational Environmental Health Center. These are things that are given to us by the various unions, particularly the Civil Service Employees Association, which has been very generous with us in giving us the bags and the coloring books. And we also have information and pencils from the Occupational and Environmental Health Center of Eastern New York. We had a table with books that were provided by the Troy Teachers Union. There were a lot of children's books that were given out, and they're all gone now, and they're all taken by families with children and grandchildren, so that we can do our bit to help education and literacy in Rensselaer County.
Herb, when we say Victorian era, we think about the elite people during that time. Well, what I want to ask you is, what was the condition of labor during the Victorian era?
Well, labor was not as strong then as it was later on. There were unions, and there was a union, the Knights of Labor, was one of the first unions active from the 1830s. And the labor unions started in this country as part of the guild system, where each particular industry had their own union and their own fights for this, and this was united after the Civil War by people like Sam Gompers, who formed the American Federation of Labor. A little later than that, the Congress of Industrial Organizations came into existence. The AFL was a union of trades, particularly, and the CIO was a union jobs that were not as skilled as the AFL jobs were. Well, labor was struggling during the Victorian era, and the robber barons had a lot of power at that time. The people who controlled the railroads and the steel industry, the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and people like that, you know, controlled the country.
How would you compare that time with, let's say, what labor's doing today, the condition of labor today?
Well, President Trump certainly would feel more comfortable in the Victorian era with the robber barons. However, we have to do what we can to fight for the interests of working people, and we have more wherewithal to do that now than they did in the Victorian era.
Now, we are nearing the end of the 2019 year. So how would you assess the labor movement this year, this past year?
Labor has had accomplishments and failures during 2019. There were accomplishments such as the organization of the Albany Medical Center and the successful strike up at Momentive, and failures such as the Green Island strike, which the United Auto Workers did not, you know, make much progress with that, and lost ground to the employers at Honeywell.
Okay. Now, the Troy Area Labor Council, y'all are based in Troy. Now, what are some of the issues and projects that y'all will be working on the coming year?
Well, we are very interested in having the apprenticeship programs in Troy succeed. We got the apprenticeship legislation back, you know, in the city of Troy with the assistance and great work from the building trades for this. And what we'd like to see is that the youth of Troy and Rensselaer County be trained for good union jobs, and that those jobs do not go to people coming in from Kentucky and Tennessee and other places and working non-union to take jobs away from people in Troy. The issues with the nurses in Albany, they're trying to break the union. They're trying to break unions all over the place, you know, and one of those places is at Albany Medical Center.
Now, Herb, I know that y'all been coming to the Victorian School for years, right?
Yes.
Now, have you got any feedback from people that, you know, that you talked to here or gave out information over the years?
Well, people love the coloring books, and they like the books that the Troy teachers gave out, and we use those things as some educational tools and for outreach into the community so that the community knows that we exist and what we have to offer.
Okay. All right, Herb. Thank you. That's Herb Henning, president of the Troy Area Labor Council. Thank you, Herb.
Thank you, Willie.
Once again, we just heard Herb Hennings, president of the Troy Area Labor Council, and it was about their participation in the recent Victorian stroll.
And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Eric. Our engineer tonight is Erica. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.